Anti-Semitism reaches a post-war high. We're talking World War II, the highest it's been since the Nazis were defeated. Welcome to Constable Confidential. I'm Simon Constable, joined by Ben Weinthal. He is a contributor to Fox News Media in New York and in Jerusalem. He's a contributor to the Jerusalem Post and the Middle East Forum. Thank you for joining us again, Ben. It's been way too long.
Yes, thanks for having me on, Simon. It's always a pleasure.
Now, there's been a lot going on lately, and the stories I've got are all from the last week, and some of them from yesterday, which is really quite incredible. The news just keeps coming out about what's going on in Israel, and also what's been going on by people who are backed and have been backed by Iran. So let's start off with the first one, the anti-Semitism, which is surging in places that you thought would never happen. Tell us about it. You wrote a very long story about this for Fox News.
Right. I did sort of a broad survey of countries, mainly in Europe and Canada, that have really been steeped in the highest levels of anti-Semitism since World War II and the end of the Holocaust in 1945. And the statistics and the data all show that outbreaks of anti-Semitic crimes are, as I said, at record levels. London is sort of the ground zero of Great Britain of this, I guess, anti-Semitic movement is how I see it. It's really a global anti-Semitic movement, mainly in the Western world. And just, I think the other day, you probably saw that the Telegraph did a big story, the Daily Telegraph, on why central London is a no-go area for Jews, and they're fleeing that area on the weekends because of these, massive, really pro-Hamas demonstrations, because many of these activists are wittingly or unwittingly demonstrating in favor of the EU and U.S. sanctioned terrorist organization Hamas. So that's London, and then I also jumped over to the European continent and explored Germany, where there was a big outbreak of anti-Semitism, a very popular film festival in Berlin, where there were a bunch of diatribes against Israel for committing genocide. And no, I mean, criticism of Israel is Israeli politicians and Israelis always say is part and parcel of the marketplace of ideas. But when you start to call for the abolition of Israel, that clearly does meet the contemporary definition of anti-Semitism. Of course, at this Berlin Film Festival, of course, I see in a very shockingly depressive way, there was no mention of freeing the hostages or over 100 hostages in being held by Hamas in Gaza. It was all about a one-sided attack on Israel. And I just had, for what it's worth, a very long conversation last night with a professor of statistics at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. And he wrote a popular article on the website of Tablet arguing why the Hamas statistics about the number of deaths are not real numbers. And he did a very exhaustive analysis that's sort of gaining a lot of traction. And he showed that the number of deaths in this war, for an urban war, is at a very low level. That is, there's one civilian death for every death of a terrorist. And that level is apparently one of the best outcome in terms of urban warfare. Of course, as he emphasized, this is all horrible when civilians die, but Israel didn't start this war. Hamas did on October 7th, and they murdered 1,200 people. And one other point I'd like to make, what is interesting, I think this was also developed by a French philosopher, if I'm not mistaken, that the outbreak of this war has produced the most anti-Semitism since the Holocaust. So there is this very weird dynamic playing out where the largest massacre of Jews since the Holocaust has actually brought about an international movement of anti-Semitism.
So which the which West, is it's that's totally bizarre. So do carry on. I'm going to come back on something.
yeah, it is bizarre, and I think that that shows in many ways how feeble many of the institutions in the West are right now in terms of combating anti-Semitism, either ignoring it or playing it down or comparing it with Islamophobia, which is a radically different form of discrimination, because anti-Semitism, the goal of anti-Semitism is the elimination of Jews, whereas Islamophobia, a term I don't really like because it was created by the Iranian regime, is about discriminating against Muslims, but it's not about eliminating Muslims as a religion.
So one thing I know, or I believe, actually, I shouldn't say I know because I certainly didn't live during this time. In the 19th century, the person who I think was the best prime minister, the best British prime minister in that century, was Benjamin Disraeli, who was Jewish. He converted to the Church of England, but he was Jewish. And then also, and so the idea of anti-Semitism rising up when you have a great icon of great ruling of the UK, basically, and the prime minister's job is an awful job, and he did it very well. And then you've also got a large Jewish population in the UK and a large Jewish population in Toronto. I used to visit Toronto quite frequently for work. What's gone on to change this, other than what you said, which is Israel being attacked and having and massacred, a huge massacre. And is that it? Is that the whole thing? Is the Jews got massacred, so therefore more people want to hate the Jews?
Well, that's a very profound question, Simon, and I think all the experts in the field are grappling with how to answer it, because anti-Semitism in many ways defies rationality and logic, and it's a vast conspiratorial theory about Jews exercising enormous amounts of power. And that's been inculcated into the psyches of many people, and obviously in Europe and in the Middle East, there's just Arab societies, including Iran, are largely infected with contemporary anti-Semitism. But the numbers are very high in liberal Western countries. I suspect a lot of it has to do with radical multiculturalism, radical identity politics, where Jews have been relegated to sort of an inferior status and not recognized as a minority, but rather as part of, in these categories of being an oppressor class, as part of all these, sort of pseudo academic theories about intersectionality. I think that plays a role, the lack of understanding of anti-Semitism, that it's an eliminatory form of discrimination, eliminatory in the sense of wanting to eliminate a group of people. And then I think also just the lack of resistance, of countervailing forces in so many of these countries. The United States is one of the exceptions, except on the university campuses, but you do see countervailing forces there, for example, in Congress confronting Harvard and MIT and Penn, three prestigious universities, about rising anti-Semitism. But in other Western countries, for example, in Germany and other countries where you don't have civil society that's more geared toward resistance, where there are lack of Jews in some of these countries. Britain, I think you see a similar phenomenon where politicians have capitulated to the anti-Semitic mobs there by in Parliament and allowing genocidal anti-Semitic phrases or phrase to be projected onto Big Ben in London, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, which is a call for the eradication of Israel.
Yeah,
But
that goes back to wanting to push Israel into the sea, which is particularly threatening when it's such a tiny country by area, and it's just it's a horrific idea. Getting my words fuddled there. This sounds like this is absolutely awful. And then we do know that in London there is a, and I should have said London, not the UK. London, there is a reasonable sized Jewish population. I hope they manage to weather this storm and stay there because it's been a great contribution to British culture. I'm going to move on now to some other things that we've discussed in the past. This is another story about, and this is from the New York Post, not by you, but it's by Isabel Vincent, and it's very interesting. And it says, the headline: Princeton faces demands to fire researcher for alleged role in Iran's campaign of terror. Tell us about who this is, because I've heard his name before, and now it's only now really coming into the news.
Right. Isabel, I congratulated her on her article. I co-authored an article with her last year, Isabel Vincent. She's an outstanding investigative journalist for the New York Post. And to her credit, she reported on Saeed Hossein Mousavian. That's the pro-Iran regime professor's name who teaches at Princeton University in New Jersey. And Mousavian is widely considered to be sort of the leading apologist for the Islamic Republic of Iran in the United States. And he was also at one point the chief spokesman for Iran's nuclear negotiating team that was going back about 20 years ago. And he's been a very important advisor to the Islamic Republic of Iran. And he's also sort of maneuvered himself into the corridors of American political power during the Obama administration. And probably right now during the Biden period, as the go-to person to try to mediate with Iran. But he's not really mediating. He's really serving as sort of a junior human resources department. That's what his critics say for Iran's regime. And what's happened here, just to go back, because this is what's new, is an organization called the Alliance Against Islamic Regime of Iran Apologists. That's a long name, but it has an acronym called IRA. Mainly of Iranian Americans who got a Iranian regime professor, pro-Iranian regime professor fired at Oberlin College, Mohalati, last year. They've launched a campaign to secure Mousavian's dismissal at Princeton. Why? Because they've publicized information that Mousavian, when he was ambassador to Germany between 1990 and 1997, oversaw terrorist operations in Europe. That resulted in the plots and deaths of over, I think the number's over 20 people. But he was certainly involved in the, according to experts, in the execution or assassination of Kurdish dissidents in a West Berlin restaurant. They were convicted, Hezbollah operatives and an Iranian agent, of killing four people in this Berlin restaurant in 1992, and then they were convicted in 97, and the Iranian government was also implicated. And Mousavian was the ambassador of the embassy at that time, the Iranian embassy. So he's a real lightning rod issue, a lightning rod personality for Iranian dissidents and also critics of the Islamic Republic of Iran across the world. So this campaign has really gained a lot of steam.
Now, there's something very interesting here about this story in the Post is that he was in some way arrested by the Iran's regime, and yet got to travel outside Iran and continue to go back and forth, even though that had happened because they said he was an enemy of the mullahs. And this all seems to be a bit sort of cross-wired. Can you explain that? Because I was mighty puzzled by it.
Right. Well, Mousavian, with whom I've had email exchanges and I've written some reports about him for Fox News Digital and Iran International, a dissident news outlet, claims that because he was opposed to one political camp, that was the presidency of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, that he was caught up in this sort of inter-party friction and was arrested. He belonged, Mousavian, to the Rafsanjani camp, who was president of Iran from the late 90s, I think, until and during the 90s, excuse me. And Rafsanjani who died a number of years ago, was considered a pragmatist. But these terms are sort of meaningless because he was really as in the same camp as all these presidents, which is the Islamic Republic has to be preserved at all costs. And that, of course, means high intensity persecution of the population and a continued drive to build a nuclear weapon. So that's what Mousavi, but he was released, as you point out, Mousavi, from this short term in jail. And then he went back to Iran even a few years ago, and he went on Iranian TV and gloated about the Iranians who regime who wants to kill Brian Hook and other politicians. Brian Hook was a special envoy for Iran during the Trump presidency, who imposed a lot of sanctions on Iran. So he went on Iranian television, Mousavi, and you can find this on the Memory website, the Middle East Media Research Institute website, the translation of his interview. And he was smiling and thrilled to hear that the Iranian regime scared Brian Hook and his wife. And he commented on it. And there's also articles in English about that. So he is, from the perspective of Iranians and many Americans, a very unsavory figure. But he, as I said, he just spoke to a major U.S. military conference last year that caused a huge controversy. And critics were asking, including Congress, why did the U.S. military invite Mousavi on to deliver a talk? And I should add, the U.S. Congress right now, the Educational Committee, is investigating Mousavi on because of his pro-Iran regime ties.
And yet these pro-Iran ties have been there for really quite a long time and pretty much out in the open. It's certainly, I don't know a massive amount about what's going on with Iran and its tentacles, but I knew that a few years ago. This all brings me on to the next report, which you wrote for Fox News Digital, and I'm going to read the headline, Biden administration under pressure to stop billions of dollars in sanctions relief to Iran. Now, we all know Iran was sanctioned heavily by the U.S. and the West because of the revolution. And now money is leaking back to Iran via the Biden administration. Have I got that wrong? I'm saying that as a fact, but it's more of a question. Is that happening or is more going to happen?
That is happening and more is going to happen. The Biden administration has continued to waive sanctions imposed on Iran because of its illicit nuclear weapons program and terrorism, but mainly its illicit nuclear weapons program. And there's unfrozen funds that Iraq has collected for with respect to payments for Iranian electricity. Iraq's government receives its electricity from Iran, and the Americans control these right now frozen funds, which I believe this amount that's going to be funneled or may have already been funneled to Iran since this story appeared a few days ago is in the area of $10 billion. Now that money, the Americans claim, will be going to a bank account that will be regulated, and the money is only for humanitarian aid, medicines, and food. But Iran's president, who was sanctioned by the American government during the Trump period, Ibrahim Raisi, for massacring thousands of Iranians, said, that's nonsense. We can use this money however we want, and there's no restrictions on it. So money, as critics have pointed out in Congress and elsewhere, financial wrongdoing experts, is fungible. So and the Iranians have been very sophisticated in bypassing sanctions and using money for nefarious purposes, including funding their proxies who murdered three American soldiers in Tower 22 in Jordan in January, and also funding the Houthis, who are, as you know from your work, firing missiles and drones at vessels, including U.S. vessels, in the Red Sea and disrupting
maritime. These are commercial vessels they're firing at. They are not so much. I mean, there have been some shots at warships, but mostly it's been at commercial vessels, which have no way to fire back because it's correct, illegal for them to have weapons on commercial vessels, because otherwise you would never know the difference between the two. So this is going to happen. And is it your expectation that the money just filters back straight through to the Houthis and maybe to Hamas and maybe to Hezbollah and all the other groups that are in the Middle East doing their terrorist thing?
Well, I think my experience with sanctions enforcement in that region of the world involves Qatar, whose financial system is riddled with finance terrorism and lack of accountability. And Qatar plays a role in the release of the unfrozen funds via their bank system. So, given the history of financial wrongdoing in the region of the Middle East, this is not Europe where there are, or the United States where there are quite strict controls over the allocation of funds, and it's a much more modernized anti-terrorism counter finance terrorism system. So I do think a lot. I suspect there's a good chance that a lot of these funds will end up, as you just said, back in the hands of Iran's regime to be sent to their terrorism proxies, the Houthis in Yemen, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and it will find its way to Hamas in the Gaza Strip, and probably in Turkey and Doha, where they have members. And again, this is an organization, Hamas, that's killed Brits, it's killed French citizens, it's killed Americans, of course, Israelis, all different nationalities, Germans. And it's really kind of shocking, given that the Hezbollah killed over 30 Americans on October 7th and still holds at least six Americans, including two dead Americans. I believe that's the current total, that the Biden administration would wave, this type of money to Iran, given that Iran's glorified the October 7th terrorism attack and helped lay the foundation for it through training.
Let's move on to what else the US is doing. The US Navy is steaming towards Gaza, if not already there now, to build a port so that humanitarian aid can be brought into Gaza by this sea route rather than a land route. Can you tell me more about what you know about that?
Right. So the president of the U.S., Biden, declared last week during the State of the Union address that he's going to set up a temporary port outside of the coast of the Gaza Strip that will enable massive amounts of humanitarian aid to be sent to the Palestinian population in Gaza, because the current system is not working due to Hamas control over it and Egyptian corruption on in the south, where there's a crossing in Rafah. So this port, temporary port in the Eastern Mediterranean, will be built. It'll take, according to the Americans, 2 months, and it'll be under the control of the Israelis. Now, it's called there's been criticism of it, because I think I read some Americans are asking, well, why is a port being built and Eastern Mediterranean, when America can't control its southern border, and terrorists and other undocumented people are entering through the south. And there's been that type of criticism I've heard in the U.S. And that, but at the, on the other hand, it may be a way to end this war, because I know on the Memory website, the founder of Memory, the former counterterrorism advisor to Yitzhak Rabin and Yitzhak Shamir, wrote that it's a port of hope. Why is it a port of hope? Because it'll remove Hamas and Qatar, Qatar's Hamas's patron, from the equation, and allow the Americans and the Israelis and the UAE and eventually Jordan to exercise
That's
control over.
the United Arab Emirates, which includes Dubai and Abu Dhabi and places like that. So that gets them involved, and they've had diplomatic relations with Israel, and Qatar is still a bit of an outlier and regarded by many as not a good place when it comes to the sponsoring of terrorism. There's also something else going on at the Eastern. Sorry, you were about to say?
No, that's right. So the main dynamic here, according to some of the experts here, and Yigal Carmon and others, that this port will be turned into a port of hope and help can bring about the victory over Hamas, because it diminishes the power of Qatar, which is trying to sustain Hamas in the south of Gaza through aid. And once Qatar's out of the equation, then Hamas will be weakened and there's a better chance to get the hostages released because of the increased pressure on Hamas. Because remember, Qatar sent over $2 billion over a 10-year period, roughly a 10-year period, to Hamas, unregulated money that allowed Hamas to build this vast military empire and underground tunnel system.
And that was truly a vast underground tunnel system, which is being destroyed. Now, back to the Eastern Mediterranean, I also happen to know, because I tend to write about commodities with some frequency, that there is an enormous natural gas deposit in the Eastern Mediterranean, which seems to border both Israel, Turkey, and Egypt. Is this building this quote-unquote temporary port, does it have anything to do with the fact that there's a massive energy find down there?
I mean, that's a, as you pointed out, that's a disputed area right now. And there's, you know, there's also, and the problem is right now is, Turkey is aligned with Qatar, of course, and Hamas. And Turkey's a bad actor because it's run by, a president Erdogan who's supports the Muslim Brotherhood, a radical organization. And he has a, he's trying to, you know, interfere, and the alliance that's set up against him is basically Greece, Cyprus, and Israel. And of course, Egypt is sort of, Israel sells gas right now to Egypt. So Egypt's there. And it's, you know, and that'll depend on, what the Americans can do with Egypt to try to, meet its needs. But it's going to be, as you point out, it's going to be a big area of dispute. There's going to be a lot to deal with it. Whether it has, I don't think it has anything to do with this port right now. But it's an interesting question. One would really need to see, to read the Turkish media to see how they view the port, which is a very interesting question, which I'm going to do actually after our interview. And because I didn't think about that point, I know that the Hamas representatives and Iran are opposed to the port and Qatar, through their media and their, you know, spokespeople, so to speak, who turn to the media to present the regime's positions in those different outlets. So the fact that Hamas, the Islamic Republic of Iran, and Qatar are opposed to the port means it's a good idea for the, from the perspective of many Israelis.
Okay, we shall see. Always lots of different views in the Middle East, which is great. Thank you very much, Benjamin Weinthal, writing for Fox News Media, the Jerusalem Post, and the Middle East Forum. I'm Simon Constable. This is Constable Confidential, and that's it.